No man is more professional than I. I am a 1% man. I am not above or below any man. I'm training my mind. I'm building my body. I'm connecting to my soul. I'm investing my money. Welcome to the 1% Man Podcast. Let's go, go, go.
Welcome back to the 1% Man Podcast. My name is Coach B. I got my good friend here, Peyton and Steve Sebold, with me. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Honored.
All right. So Steve has been a professional speaker for quite some time now. He is past the era of being a guru, I can say. He's very acclaimed. He's been in so many, I think over 120 TV features as well. He trains sales professionals throughout the world as well. I'm working with a lot of big companies like Transamerica, World Health. So he knows his stuff. So I want you to tune in and listen up to what he has to say as well, gentlemen. So big thing is, Steve, I want to ask you a few questions so the listeners can get to know you. Is that cool?
Sure.
Okay, perfect. So if you could speak to your 18-year-old self, what is one piece of advice you would give them and why?
That's a good question. I would say keep moving forward because it's going to get really good pretty fast.
Got you. Especially in your career and everything that you've done. Definitely moving forward to something that you have done. I know you spoke a lot about your failures and even interviewing millionaires that you've done too. Almost like the modern day Napoleon Hill. So totally love that. Second question is, if you weren't a professional speaker, a sales trainer, a multimillionaire, what would you be doing and why?
I'd probably be a novelist or a psychologist. I was headed toward being a psychologist years ago, and I ended up kind of getting the feeling that academia was going to be a little bit slow off the mark. And they are a little bit slow off the mark, in my opinion. I basically taken academic research and sold it back to Fortune 500 companies for the last 30 years. But I probably would have been a researcher or even a novelist, maybe some kind of writer, probably.
Sweet. And what area of novelist would you be? Like, what topic would you go down?
Oh, probably making up some crazy stories, you know, stuff like that. I like to write. That's my thing. That's my favorite thing to do. So sweet.
Well, yeah. That is, I can definitely see that because I've read a lot of your columns. You just had a new column come up. I think it was like CNBC. I just saw your new column that came up. So yep, definitely so. And then third question is, if there was one value you believe that you could teach all men to adopt to make it a better place for everyone, what value would it be and why?
That's a really good question. I would say probably... I mean, this might sound bad, but I think for most people, it's probably something to think about at least. And that's to focus on becoming financially independent, not so you can buy a bunch of stuff necessarily. I mean, that's fun too, but be financially independent so you can run your own life. You can, you know, live your own, make your own rules, you know, within the context, obviously, of laws and, you know, society to make sure it's good for everyone. But you can live your own life. You don't have to be beholden to anyone for your entire life. And that's just a different life that most people, I think, really only can imagine. So I would say that focus on becoming financially independent.
Nice. Could you explain to people what financial independence is? Different people throw out different terms, right? Like Dave Ramsey has like, oh, debt-free, right? But what does financial independence look like when you explain it in this context?
More money than you need.
I love it. Short and sweet. So, and that goes to my next question and final question is, now that you have more money than you need, you have been super successful, featured everywhere. You could buy any toy that you want to buy, expensive, non-expensive, and you have done all the things that you've always wanted to do. What keeps you going and waking up and saying, you know what, I want to get up and I want to keep going? What keeps you driven to keep producing, to keep helping people, sales trainers, and keep writing books? You just wrote another book. So what keeps you going to keep doing that?
Yeah, the work itself. I mean, the intrinsic, you know, rewards that the work of itself of, you know, for me, at least writing and then speaking about whatever you wrote, whatever is your latest book or project or whatever it is. And just the reward you get from doing the actual work, not so much the money. And the money's great, but I think it's more, to me, there's more value in the reward of writing something that actually helps someone, or, you know, giving a speech or a seminar or workshop or something that really helps someone. That's very rewarding on an intrinsically. And I think that's what really keeps me going. I just really enjoy doing what I do. But again, you have to have the money to be able to do what you want to do. And I think it starts there.
I love that you said in your book, how world-class thinkers think, you brought up that, you know, you never, you don't want to, passion will make you broke if you're not, if you don't already have the money to do what you really want to do. Could you break that down a little more and explain it to people? Because I think academia and when we're growing up, they teach us, hey, follow your passion and the money is going to come. But a lot of times people like teachers, they are super passionate about what they're doing, but yet the money isn't coming. Or professional people that are artists or they want to go be celebrities. And then they're like, oh, well, they find out that, you know what? I get this degree. I have, you know, $100,000 hanging on the wall, but I'm deep in debt. So could you explain that a little more about why that's important?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I mean, you know, when I was coming up in my 20s too, that was kind of when all that, it seemed to me anyway, that that's when that all started. But follow your passion and, or, you know, pursue your passion and the money will follow, you know, kind of a thing. Love what you do, the money will follow, those kinds of things. And it's a great idea. I mean, it really is. I mean, it's a beautiful idea. And I hadn't really heard that before. That was kind of a new thing that seemed to be coined in the United States, that new kind of a philosophy. But to your point, Bertrand, the problem is that, you know, not everything, like you're saying, teaching. I mean, thank God we have teachers that want to go to school every day with kids and help them out. And they're never going to have a lot of money, most likely, at least doing that. So someone's got to do those jobs. So, I mean, I really respect the people that do those things. But I would say if I was coaching someone or trying to make a recommendation, I would say that, yeah, definitely follow your passion. Absolutely. Because if you don't love the work you do, then it's all about the reward, let's say money or whatever other rewards you're getting, you know, recognition or whatever. But once that's over, it's like buying things, material things. Doesn't matter how big they are. You know, after a while, it's just a thing and there's no, you're left hollow. So I think that you got to love what you do, but if you possibly can do it, you know, focus on something that has some margin, some financial potential. So you don't have to answer to someone else the rest of your life. That's the only reason I wanted money. I just didn't want to answer to someone else. It was never about living in a big house or, you know, all the stuff. It was more about just freedom. So I think if you can take your freedom, you find what you're passionate about and then direct it towards something where you can become financially independent, you've won the lottery.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, Peyton, I know you have some great questions you want to ask too. You want to start chopping them away?
Oh, please. Yes. Killing it. I'm itching. I know. So Steve, I know I already said this before we started recording, but I do want to honor you because I would throw you up there in terms of influence in my life, right up with Jim Rohn and Tony Robbins. Really made it huge, turned me into the salesperson that I am today, reading your content. And, This is the very first copy of your book. It's basically all painted with highlighters. And one of the things that I was really curious about, and I was so excited to ask you about, you know, 177 Mental Toughness Secrets of the World Class was published in 2004. You know, so I'm really curious to know, has your perspective on mental toughness like changed or evolved over time since publishing that book?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the kind words. Yeah, absolutely. It has. I mean, I not, you know, foundationally, I mean that not really, because it really came from so many years of interviewing self-made millionaires. I've been doing that now since I'm continuing to do it since 1984. And even in 2004, it was still a long time and, you know, tons and tons of interviews. So it hasn't changed fundamentally, but some of the edges that I've had over the years have hardened a little bit. Just as you do, as an entrepreneur, as you build more businesses and you have more struggles, you have more successes and all the rest of it. And in between, I think you harden a little bit, your edges harden a little bit because you realize that, like, for example, I'll give you an example. I'm being too ethereal probably, but like, you know, you've heard this before. I think it was in Thinking Grow Rich. It's been in tons of books and I'm sure I've said it on stage before on in media or whatever, you know, burn the boats, you know, well, if you're going to be an entrepreneur, well, burn the boats, that whole philosophy. And I think in 2004, I'd have said, yeah, burn the boats. And I've done that, you know, the idea, if people aren't familiar, the idea that give it all, if you're going to be in a business, well, put everything on the line and don't let yourself have that boat to get away from, you know, to get away from, to rescue you, so to speak. And that today I would say, I was just telling an audience out in Phoenix the other day, you know, I said, yeah, burn your boats, but make sure you understand that the person that's saying that has a boat tied up in the back that you can't see just in case things go wrong, because things go wrong and you don't want to be left out. It sounds real sexy. It's one of those things that, like in personal development, sounds really good on stage and sounds good in the book and on TV and all the rest of it. But it's probably a dumb idea because things do go wrong and you do need a fallback plan sometimes. You know, certainly be committed, but don't put yourself in a spot where you can go broke. A lot of entrepreneurs do that. And it's really, in my opinion, it's a big mistake, but I wouldn't have said that in 2004.
Yeah. That makes a ton of sense. That makes a ton of sense. Bertrand actually asked you a little bit about this, and he briefly touched on it, but I think one of my favorite illustrations in your book around mental toughness is how champions love playing the game. And you've been playing the game for a while. And I really treasure and honor that like longevity and that consistency that you have about you. What is right now in your current season of life? Like what is the most exciting part of the game for you? What are you really excited about and passionate about right now?
Yeah, I've got a new book out with a co-author named Tom Matthews called How Money Works, Stop Being a Sucker. And the book's been really successful. We sold 500,000 copies so far in the last 2 years, I guess. And it was the number one personal finance book of 2020. And basically the reason I think it's so successful is it's such a simple book. Like we wrote it so a 14-year-old kid could understand it. Mm. And it's got pictures in there. Like it's a cartoon book almost. It's not, but it could be considered at that level. And we wanted, but the information in there is pretty much what the masses, most people, unless they've got, you know, tens of millions of dollars in net worth to invest, it's really what most of us would need to be financially successful. So it's powerful information, but it's very simple. So there's 10,000 of us around the country that are teaching these little classes in companies and churches and schools. And we're talking, of course, I've done 200 and something television interviews about the book in the last year and a half or whatever. So the media loves it because it's simple and it's kind of a book written for the rest of us on money. And so I'm passionate because I want people to understand how money really works at the basic level. You know, I'm not a Wall Street, I don't trade derivatives on Wall Street. I'm not a hedge fund manager, any kind of brilliant genius like that, but or a quant or anything. But I know the basics, and the basics have helped me, like it's helped a lot of other people become financially independent. And, you know, again, it kind of goes back to that freedom thing. Now you can do whatever you want to do. And I think more people, if they had a chance, it's not taught in schools. And if they had a chance, they're absolutely smart enough and educated enough to make it work. And once you understand the basics of how money works, you really can't ever spend, save, or invest the same way ever again. It changes everything you do with money. So yeah. I'm passionate about trying to get that message out there a little bit.
I love your perspective on money. I grew up in church, and I'm very grateful that my parents brought me up in a church with great values. But obviously, I think you probably know where I'm going with this. It's like there's the, you know, it's easier or it's difficult for a rich man to be able to make it into heaven, and like easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle. And I've had to reconstruct and reprogram my mind and my relationship with money. And your book, How Rich People Think, actually helped a lot with that. This is a direct quote from it. The average person spends an inordinate amount of time worrying about money while simultaneously denying its significance. Why is that a cultural norm? Is that an America thing? Is it a humanity thing? Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think that most people don't understand money. For one, it's intimidating to them, but I think also the idea, and it probably came, as you mentioned, Peyton, a lot from the church, where it's you're trained and taught to feel guilty if you want more than, you know, just enough to survive. And so they make you feel guilty, although, you know, nothing against the church, but they do take your money every Sunday pretty. And then you can give as much as you want. And then some, you know, churches do tithing. So you're giving 10% of your gross income. Yeah. I'm going to start a church my next life. But anyway, that's another story. But tax-free income, by the way, but I won't get off on that because we already talked about, we're not going to get into that. So I won't go there. But I think, yeah, to your point, I think it's a cultural norm. And I found it, you know, we've started businesses and operated businesses in 10 countries around the world, and mostly in countries with the Western influence. So I will say that, but, you know, especially at the United States, because we're financially so successful and we're the success oriented country. You know, we're the ones that are obsessed with success compared to the rest of the world, good or bad. We certainly are. It's good to me. I mean, I think other countries don't think that's a good thing, but that there are certainly more important things than money. But at the same time, you know, we know we need money. The more of it, the better. I mean, it makes your life easier. It doesn't make you any happier. And I think that's another thing that's misconstrued, is that, once I buy all the stuff, it's all gonna make me happier. I mean, certainly things are fun to have and the rest of it. But after a while, you know, I've lived in small houses and I've lived in huge houses, and they're houses. They have bathrooms. They have the bigger bathroom, bigger kitchen, bigger living room, bigger bedroom, but they're still houses. It's still a car. You know, I've had all the fancy cars I think you can buy, or a lot of them anyway, like a lot of people. And, you know, they're just cars after a while that get from A to B, and it's, you get used to it. you know, but again, I think that, that it's a real problem, and I'll just speak for this country or as a citizen of this country anyway, that, you know, we tell people that it's not important because it's one of the most important things in life. And if you don't, you're either going to, you know, you're either going to make your own rules or you're going to answer someone that had, because you have money, you're going to answer someone that, that has money and that you're going to play by their rules. And why would you want to spend the one life you get playing by someone else's rules? I don't know. It doesn't seem that attractive to me.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And I think you, you also brought up schools, and I really, I resonate with that because I didn't, I never learned financial literacy in school. Bertrand, did you?
No, never did.
Interesting. What, why do you think schools are dropping the ball when it comes to just teaching people basic financial literacy and the importance and how to put money to work?
Oh yeah. It's the financial lobby. Yeah. The financial lobby is the most powerful lobby in the United States. I mean, they outrank the gun lobby, everybody, because they it's the richest industry in the history of the world. You know, they measure their money in the trillions and they don't want it in schools. They literally, I mean, I've worked as a vendor too, as for both my books and speeches and seminars and consulting for the financial industry. I mean, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, you name it. I've worked for them pretty much across the board, the big, most of the big ones. And I've been in closed door meetings with those guys as a consultant where they said, look, you know, the more ignorant people are about money, the richer we get. And I mean, they didn't say it exactly like that, but that's what effectively what they were saying. And so they don't want it in the schools. They blocked it in the schools for years and they continued to do that. They don't want the curriculum in the schools because if we find out how much of a ripoff most of the financial products are, or a fair amount of the financial products are, we wouldn't buy them. And they wouldn't be, you know, they wouldn't be living in these giant 400 story buildings in New York and Chicago and LA. So they don't want it in schools. And unfortunately, you know, we're sort of the kids are the victim. I didn't learn it in school either. I don't know anyone that ever did. Not enough. And you literally could take, like, I'm going to the schools. We're going to the schools with this book and we're giving copies away and saying, look, we can teach this to you in these kids probably in 2 or 3 hours, everything they need to know pretty much about money. The basic level on investing, saving, that, because it's not that complicated. If you want someone to learn it, it's actually not that complicated, but they don't want people to learn it because again, they, it costs them a lot of money if they do.
Yeah.
No, well, that's so true. So true.
I could. Yeah, no, same. I think so. What advice would you give so many of our clients and people that are in Bertrand and I's circle, brilliant business owners, great at generating and collecting cash, but we've got a lot of people in our circle that might be cash heavy, but they are investment poor. They are wealth poor. And so what advice would you give to someone that they weren't taught financial literacy, but they have surplus and they just don't know how to put it to work? How would you, what advice would you give them either on their mindset or just even just basic things that really helped you when you first started making money?
Well, I would say think big, but live below your means. And that means your company's means as well as your personal means. I mean, just look at the pandemic. I mean, none of us, I don't think any of us saw a 2-year shut, the whole world shuts down. If they would have told us that, someone had said that to all of us, we'd say, you know, that's impossible. That cannot happen, including me. I mean, just, I don't think any of us would have believed that it was possible to shut down the whole economic engine of the world. But, you know, we've seen it happen. I own two companies, for example, that are live event companies, and they've both lost millions of dollars in the last 2 years since the pandemic. I mean, we have almost no revenue. I mean, it's a little, like a little here, there, we've got some coming in now, like a tiny bit of it, but we've literally, those two companies have probably lost at least $10 million each in the last 2 years. And so like, if, you know, if we hadn't lived below our means in terms of the company coffers, as well as our personal coffers, you know, that would have been a pretty bad thing. So I think that entrepreneurs have to be very, very careful. We're optimists, honestly, you know, I mean, obviously by default as entrepreneurs and people going after dreams. So we think everything's going to be rosy all the time, which is probably what keeps us going. But at the same time, I think you have to have a practical side of you that says, look, what if it doesn't? What if business goes up and down? They're all cyclical, you know, like markets, they're all cyclical and economies and everything anywhere in the world. And so I think you want to be careful. You want to make sure, again, you got a boat tied up in the back of the island while you're burning the other ones, because just in case, no one's coming to your rescue. We save ourselves as entrepreneurs, but I think it's one of the reasons, you know, people, it's a joke, sort of a running joke, as you guys know, that when people say, well, if you haven't been broke sometime in your life, gone bankrupt or declared bankruptcy, you're not a real entrepreneur. Well, I don't really believe that's true. I know a lot of entrepreneurs, thousands of them, and very few of them have ever gone broke or declared. Not that that's a terrible thing, but it's because they played it too loose. They're playing fast and loose with cash, and that's a very dangerous thing to do. So I'd say be conservative, live below your means, but still think big and move forward. Be optimistic, but be careful as well. Be practical, because things do change, and sometimes it's beyond your control.
Well, yeah. Now, my brother who turned me on to all of your content, Taylor, he wrote this and he tells me this all the time. The rich accumulate money, the wealthy trade money for assets. Can you talk a little bit about like your first experience trading money for assets and what advice you would give for people that are also like, okay, I need to get my foot into actually trading fiat for assets that will grow in value?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great idea. You know, Kiyosaki talks about it really, really well. Other people talked, Ray Dalio talks about that. A lot of really good financial minds out there. I think for me personally, I mean, just one entrepreneur, my assets have always been the companies we've developed. So the goal at least we've had is, you know, passive income while you're sleeping or building another business or sitting on your boat or whatever, or working mm-hmm. where the money's coming in, whether you're there or not, like you're not necessary to the company. Not easiest thing to do. Most entrepreneurs are really not entrepreneurs. They have jobs. They just work for themselves. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I've done the same thing, you know, over the years. But we've always tried to take the profits we've had from other businesses that we've started and then start another business to solve another problem, hopefully within the same group of companies that we currently own. So they're dovetailed in. But passive income more than anything else. Although, you know, there's lots of other ways to your point, like Kiyosaki talks about whether it's real estate or other income producing assets that have great advantages. I've always been like to start new businesses with new partners in different countries and stuff like that. Just had more fun doing it, but and having passive income be the cash producing asset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amazing.
When you were talking, I really wanted to ask you this because I think a lot of men nowadays, they're a lot of lone wolves, right? A lot of people want to like kind of beat their chest and be like, hey, I'm the guy that did this by myself. Do you feel like you have to do that nowadays? Or do you feel like relationships and building community is more important for that, especially as a man?
I think I've never been able to do it by myself. I guess I'm not that bright. I mean, there are people that are. I mean, I think, you know, guys like Elon Musk and, you know, some of these guys are just, and I've interviewed some of these guys over the years, you know, self-made millionaires. And self-made really is just, I always say self-made millionaire. I sit on TV every day or whenever, radio, whatever. And what I really mean by it, at least personally, is people didn't inherit their wealth. They actually made their money. Not that they did it themselves. That's, you know, pretty much ridiculous across the board, but there are these geniuses that can do these things. I'm just not currently one of them. I'm clearly not one of them. So I like working with partners and employees that are smarter. And then I haven't had a hard time finding those people, right? There's so many of them out there. But, you know, working with people together, I think you can do a lot more. You can be a lot broader in your reach. I mean, that's how we've worked in other countries, because there's different laws, there's different regulations in other countries, there's politics, there's culture, societal norms you have to adapt to, and those kinds of things. And so we partnered with people in those other countries, and they kind of led us along the path. But I think that, you know, my old friend Brian Tracy from California talks about this. And he says, you'll never live long enough to learn all these things you have to learn if you really want to be successful, unless you're some kind of genius. Again, if you are, great. But for the rest of us mere mortals, you know, we get other people with other strengths. And I found it's a lot of fun working with other people, because when you succeed, it's a blast. And when you're failing, you're in the fight together and you kind of find out who the person really is. And it's a lot of fun to work with groups. So I would say mentorship and partnership and all those things are just, that's the way to go, at least in my opinion.
True. That's so true. For myself, the first time I made my big investment, it was with Peyton and his company. And that was like, for me to be able to get into a room with other people that were making way more money than I was making. I think at the time I was making like $1,500 a month. Right. And I invested into this program and I met somebody that made $250,000. Alec was making $250,000 a month. And I was just like, that blew my mind, because I was like, I've never met somebody. And to me, the perception of someone that made that much money didn't look like him. I was just like, oh, wait, if he can do it, then I'm pretty sure I can do it too. And then I met other people that were making like $5,000 in a day or $10,000 this month. And I was just like, wow, you guys don't look like what a millionaire should look like. You know, because I was expecting them to have jewelry, watches, big cars, you know, like the most fanciest clothes, because that's what we were taught growing up. You know, that's the image that was always portrayed as people having money. So that totally flipped me. And I totally believe in mentorship and having community. So these are like my last two questions. Number one, this is more of like an open kind of concept. But is there anything that we may have asked you or touched on that you were like, you know what, I kind of want to go a little deeper. I want to expunge upon that. Is there anything that we kind of asked you that you said you want to expunge upon?
I think that, you know, you made a good point, what you just said, Bertrand. I think that, you know, it's like, what do we expect these rich people, or call them rich people or independent people, financially independent people, whatever we want to label them. You know, what do they look like? What do they? I mean, I got to tell you, I live outside of Atlanta. And my neighbors were all very, very disappointed. I think when I two years ago, I guess it was when I bought two new cars and I bought two Kias, and people say, well, poor people drive Kias. It's like, well, they're actually pretty good cars, but they're a lot cheaper than my Range Rovers I had before that. So I traded up two Range Rovers in, yeah, or a Cadillac and a Range Rover for two Kias. I think people are very disappointed that some of these wealthy people in, that live around my neighborhood here have said, well, you know, why would you drive a Kia? I mean, why would you? I'm like, they're really good cars for one thing. I really like it. But their perception is that because if they think you have money, well, then you're driving some kind of Ferrari or something like that. And typically people that do that don't have any money. They're trying to show people, like, pretend they have money. But the people that, to your point, you know, what do they look like? What does the average millionaire look like in America? The average millionaire drives an F-150, 10 years old. They keep their cars for 10 years, not just cars, but they live in normal houses. Typically some live in bigger ones, but a lot of them live in normal houses. They have normal clothes. Their kids go to public schools. I mean, they're not what we kind of see on TV, I guess, maybe. For most of us, that's our, you know, that's our exposure to millionaires, let's say. You know, we see it on TV and it's in LA somewhere where everything's flashy and fake and all the rest of it a lot of times. And we see that and go, well, these aren't the, and I'm like you, I would interview these people starting in 1984 and think, you know, they're living like in a regular house. And I'm thinking, where's their mansion? Where's their Ferrari? Where's their yacht? And a lot of them never live. Warren Buffett's one of them. Warren Buffett lives in the same house he's lived in for 50 years. It's a normal house in Omaha. And he's a very down to earth guy and all the rest of it. And you think he wouldn't be, you know, certainly one of the richest people in the world, but they think differently. They're not doing it for flash. They're doing it for independence, security, and probably a lot better and more noble reasons than what we see on television, let's say.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I do want to just add this one question in here real quick, is that you believe in vision boards. I remember you talked about, you have a vision board. Now, could you talk real quick about how you create yours? Do you still cut like pictures out, or how do you create yours? Because there's a lot of people that do vision board parties, but no one really talks about, okay, hey, this is how you actually make a vision board, and coming from someone that has money. So what does that look like?
Okay. I guess I did it for a long time. I was telling the story in the Phoenix the other day in this group about how Time Magazine called me years ago, like, I don't know, 10 years ago, something like that, 15 years ago. They called me and said, oh, we're doing a story on, you know, self-made millionaires, da, da, da. And I had worked with them before because I worked with the media almost every day. So I knew a lot of guys there, but this guy, I didn't know. So anyways, long story short, we want to bring a crew of five people to one of your houses, take pictures, video, and do an interview. And we're interviewing, like, they were interviewing like five self-made millionaires around the country. So I said, sure. So we had a lake house up in north of Atlanta on Lake Lanier, and it was a nice house and big view and everything, pretty cool house. And so they came out there, the crew, and they go down to the base. There's three stories, and I had a gym in the basement, not like a huge gym, but nice little gym that I was the only person that used it. And it was good. So I had an elliptical machine and I had a TV on the wall, so I could watch TV while I was doing the elliptical machine and working out. And then I had my four vision boards left of the TV, so I could look at the vision boards while I was watching TV and doing my workout. And the guy started laughing and he said, you don't tell me you cut these, like, pictures, like you cut out, like you're saying. He said, don't tell me you cut these out of a magazine, like a little, like a fourth grader cuts out pictures and pays. Like, did you put scotch tape on them? And I'm like, yeah, put scotch tape on them too. Yeah, that's what I do on Saturday night, man. Which is not that far from the truth, you know, like a lot of entrepreneurs. But anyway, the point of it was that he was laughing. He was very condescending and he was laughing at me. They put it in the piece, the article, but he made fun of it. And I thought to myself, it's kind of strange. He's interviewing me and he's laughing at me in my own house. Yeah. It's kind of weird. But I think that people don't really understand the basic things like that. I mean, I didn't read that in the book. I got that from interviews with self-made millionaires in the 80s. They said, look, cut stuff out on a board and put it on there, you know, on like a poster board, like you do when you're a kid, and tape it up there, put words on there, whatever it is you want to move toward, because all you're doing is creating a visual representation of your future. And you want to move toward those pictures. And we all know that's the way the mind works. We move toward words. We move toward pictures. It's basic psychology. I mean, any psychologist will tell you that works. It's not magic. Of course, the things don't appear in your driveway the next day, or if it's a car or a house, or, I mean, obviously that's ridiculous. I mean, it's just a visual representation to get you continuing to think about consciously these things you want. So I'm at the point, I guess now it might sound funny, but I've gotten most of the stuff I can cut out and pay, you know, magazines or something, or I just stop wanting it or something like that. So I don't have a lot of those things, but I do have vision boards, and it's more about doing the kind of work I want to do and helping, trying to get whatever message I have out to as many people as possible before I'm gone, and just try to help people, because other people have helped me. Without the help of mentors and successful people that were just willing to give for free, basically, or for whatever reason that they enjoy doing it, you know, I'd have a job somewhere doing something I probably wouldn't enjoy, and earning an average income, just because, but because so many people have been so nice to me over the years, I've been able to live the way I wanted to. And it'd be nice to be able to give some of that back.
Yeah. That actually goes in line with my last question is, when it's all said and done for you and you're about to take your final breaths, like, what do you want your legacy to be remembered and how do you want to be remembered?
The books. To me, the writing of the books, you know, I mean, I'm not John Grisham or, you know, probably any great writer or anything like that, but that's my thing. I like to write, like we were talking before, and it's fun to like to go out again. I just got back from Phoenix and I worked with a big group out there, and you know, it was fun. It's fun to have people come up to you and say, "Hey, you know, I read something," or like Peyton was saying, and you were saying, you know, that it made a difference here, a difference there. That's a really cool feeling. I really like that. The idea that your legacy, if this is something you like to do, is out there in writing, you know, it's out there in a book form. It's going to outlast you. If it's a good book, it's going to outlast you. You know, I never knew the 177 when I wrote that book. That was my first book. I didn't know that book was going to go over all over the world and sell copies that book sells copies every day and has never been off the bestseller list of basic personal development books in since 2004. And I didn't know that when you write it, sometimes books resonate. Sometimes I've written books that didn't resonate with the public, you know, at all. And so I just think the it's cool to have your thoughts and ideas out there, and not everybody likes them or not everyone agrees, but some people do. So some people are getting help that you'll never meet in your life. And I think that's a pretty cool legacy. It excites me.
Amazing.
Yes, true, true. So what is the best way for people, like after they hear all this, how can they get into your world and your sphere and connect with you and what you have going on?
I have several different, I work a lot, you know, again, like I said, with the media a lot, but I've got a blog called Mental Toughness Blog. .com. So they can check that out, or I'm an easy Google search if they want to get on social media or whatever like that. Most of that stuff's online. So it's pretty, I'm pretty easy to find.
True. You are very easy to find.
Well, the media does that for you. Yeah.
Sure. True. So Steve, thank you so much for coming on. Peyton as well. Questions were just outstanding. And I appreciate the freedom that you gave information to as well. Like you didn't hold back whatsoever. Very well explained. So whoever's listening probably got tons of value from here as well. So thank you so much, Steve, for coming on.
Well, yeah. Thanks, Bertrand. Thanks, Peyton. I appreciate you guys. Keep doing what you're doing, man. You guys are doing good work. It's helping a lot of people.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
You heard it here first. Your legacy starts today.
Thank you, my friend, for tuning into today's episode. This means so much to us over here at the 1% Man community. Now, we want to extend a hand of gratitude to you. So I have a free gift for you. All you have to do is go to www.the1percentman.com/podcast gift. This is an exclusive gift for listeners that tune into our podcast. So go over there, get that free gift as well. And now I have two simple acts of you. One, hit that subscribe button and leave us a comment and a 5-star review, because that helps us to see what you love about the podcast, and that helps us to bolster up in the rankings so more people can find us and listen to this pertinent information that we have for men of today's age. Last but not least, I want you to go back and listen to this podcast. Find just one thing that you can implement in your life today so you can move forward. Remember, progress over perfection. And till next time, my friend, your legacy starts today.